I'll do it anyway. He's coming? Okay, I'll wait then. So today I want to finish talking about correlators and then start talking about finite temperature. So I wanted to answer your question, which yesterday at the end I was talking about what to do in the holographic dual gravity description if you want to try to compute retarded Green's functions, more generally, we observe that there's a certain multiplicity of solutions of the wave equation in real time, in say anti de Sitter space, and I was trying to convince you that this multiplicity reflects the many possible Green's functions that you might want to compute in a quantum system in real time, and I gave this sort of very appealing but perhaps not completely rigorous argument that the boundary conditions to put in the infrared on your solution of the wave equation, if you want to compute the retarded Green's function, is infalling boundary conditions, namely stuff should fall into the horizon. But here's an independent argument for this, which might be more satisfying and which will tell you the answer to how do you compute the Feynman-Green's function, for example. So a quantum mechanics fact, a fact that just follows from the definition of the retarded Green's function that I wrote down last time, is that the retarded Green's function in frequency space and momentum space is related to the Euclidean Green's function, that is the Green's function that you compute in Euclidean time, which is completely specified by some, if you like, by some path integral with some positive measure where there's no subtlety at all. It's related to it by replacing the frequency here by appending some factors of I in the right places. So this minus I here is just the statement that the frequency conjugate to real time is related by a factor of I compared to the frequency. So this is what you might call the Euclidean frequency, the frequency conjugate to Euclidean time. But this plus I epsilon is the real content, because it says that if this thing has some poles somewhere, say at a value of this omega which is on the real axis, then the poles of this thing will lie all in the lower half plane and never in the upper half plane. So for example, suppose we think about the singularities of, so this is the complex frequency plane, this axis is the real frequency axis. So suppose we consider the singularities of, say, the free momentum space propagator of a free massive scalar. It's something like omega squared minus p squared p vector squared minus m squared. I just wanted to check which signature I was in. So you see this. This is the real. This omega is the real frequency. You see, so this thing has singularities on the real axis at plus or minus e sub p, which is square root of p vector squared plus m squared, and minus e sub p. And this prescription of adding an I epsilon here, if you like, moves the singularities into the lower half plane, or moves the integration contour a little bit above the real axis. And so with this integration contour for defining the Fourier transform back to position space, this gives the retarded Green's function. In contrast to the fact, in contrast to this definition of the Feynman propagator, which is related by taking the Euclidean propagator, one way to do it is something like this. We can put here e to the minus I pi over 2 minus epsilon here omega comma k vector, And this way of putting the epsilon will replace the contour instead by this familiar thing where the contour does this, right? And so therefore one of the poles is in the upper half plane and one of the poles is in the lower half plane. And this produces, by Fourier transform, the time ordered Green's function, as opposed to the retarded Green's function, which is, is a nice thing because it's the thing that comes out of path integrals. Is a reason to study this thing. And notice that it treats positive and negative frequencies asymmetrically. That is, something whose frequency has a positive real part ends up in the lower half plane, and something whose frequency has a negative real part ends up in the lower half plane. So that is, positive and negative frequencies are asymmetric. This prescription, this way I've written it, this replacement is maybe a little bit unfamiliar. So here, you can think of this as omega goes to omega plus I epsilon. It shifts the contour up a little bit. Another way to do this, which is probably familiar from QFT classes, is just replace omega squared by omega squared plus I epsilon. That will also accomplish the same effect. Okay, so that's the relationship between the retarded Green's function and the Feynman Green's function. And the reason I mention this prescription is that this relation here between the Euclidean Green's function, which we know unambiguously how to compute holographically from some particular solution, which is an analytic function of the frequency, and the retarded Green's function, we can use to give independent evidence for this prescription. That is, so here's my holographic version. I know how to compute the solution of the Euclidean scalar equations of motion or Euclidean equations of motion for whatever field I'm interested in. This is Bessel K, if you like, not as opposed to Bessel I. It's uniquely specified by this regularity condition. And to get from it the retarded Green's function, the solution of the bulk wave equation, which produces the retarded Green's function. So this thing, this is a function of the radial coordinate. It's a function of frequency. It's a function of momentum. I'm going to put the frequency here. And this thing is a function of frequency, momentum, and the radial coordinate. To get this from this, I just do the same replacement in the frequency. So put a minus I omega plus I epsilon here. And so because this function is an analytic function of frequency and also of these other variables, this produces the right function here. And it's possible and not too hard to check that this agrees. If you do this with the Bessel K, it agrees with the ingoing condition. It gives you the solution, which is ingoing at the horizon. All right, so this is maybe a more convincing argument for this prescription. Okay. But something that you should all be anxious about or dissatisfied about is that I've told you how to find which is the right solution, but I haven't told you what to do with the solution. So let's talk about that. Rather, what to do with the solution to get the Green's function. So let's look at the solution again near the boundary. So the solution of interest, whatever it is, let's think in position space for a second. But if you like, actually, this x could be that label is just going to go along for the ride. It could be just as well the frequency space or momentum space. The solution behaves near the boundary. We've argued as for small z, it behaves like z over L. L is the ADS radius that I'm putting there just for dimensional analysis reasons, to the delta minus times some times phi naught, which is our source, phi naught of x. This is something we pick. And then there's some subleading bits of the solution, 1 plus some things that go like 1 plus order z over L, things that are small when z is small compared to L. I guess, yeah, here I really mean z less than L. And then there's another solution. So this is one linearly independent solution. The other solution is z over L to the delta plus times some coefficient, which you can imagine extracting, for example, by fitting the function near z equals 0. Which I'll call phi 1. And again, there's some subleading bits that are important to worry about in doing this, extracting this function. And I guess I should say this is the form of the solution if delta plus minus delta minus is not an integer. If delta plus minus delta minus is an integer, then you'll notice that it's easy to confuse the subleading bits in here with some of these bits, right? Because you see, you know, suppose delta minus is equal to something, and delta plus is equal to that something minus 1, right? Then z to the delta minus plus 1, which is one of the terms here, would be the same as this. And the solutions to the differential equations know how to escape from this problem. Does anybody know how they escape from it? The answer is logarithms. So you know this. I mean, this happens just for like the equation. I'm sorry. The problem that if delta plus minus is an integer. I'll try not to write over here. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll try to log this off. So the thing it says here is just if delta plus minus is an integer, then we need to worry about the fact that you know this is in fact not the right solution. This happens for the harmonic oscillator, right? If you have an overdamped oscillator where you make it so that the two roots of the equation are the same, you get a logarithm, right? No? Nobody knows about this? Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's some fancy word, but I mean, it happens for the harmonic oscillator. okay, should I? You're going to be really mad at me if I spend time reminding you of this, because I'm sure you all know this. Okay, let me just do it, because you know we're doing all kinds of fancy stuff here. This is more important. So think about the following thing. Let's call the coordinate of the oscillator y. So y double dot plus a y double dot plus b y dot plus c y is equal to 0. Think about this differential equation. All right, I can solve it by, what's it called? The Fourier method, e to the I omega t. Right, then put some coefficient here. And then I want to find omega so that this is a solution, so I plug this in. This gives me a omega minus a omega squared plus I b omega plus c all times a is equal to 0. Right, and so the roots of this equation are something. I guess omega is. I should have put different numbers here. What is it? Plus or minus? No, it's b over 2 plus or minus square root of b minus b squared minus plus 4ac over minus 2a. Right, something like that. I probably did it wrong, but then notice that these did I mess up. Yeah, good, thank you. Excellent. Thank you. And so notice that sometimes this is equal to 0, right, if I choose b and a and c poorly. And in that case, the two roots are equal, right? And so it seems like we've only found one solution, even though it's a second-order equation, right? And the other solution is instead t times e to the I omega t, right? And that's what I mean by a logarithm is it's this plus log t. Right. So the same thing happens here in that case. Okay? It's just that, you know, the differential equation knows that it's supposed to have two solutions and logarithms are the way that it solves this problem. Alright? So if this is true, then instead there's a logarithm here. So just keep in mind that if these two things happen to differ by an integer, there's an invisible logarithm. All right? If you nod more, I won't subject you to this kind of thing, which maybe you may choose to do, even if you don't actually know what I'm talking about. So this is the behavior near the boundary, and we want to figure out how to extract the answer. And the reason, one reason to focus on the behavior near the boundary is, remember, if we were talking about the Euclidean case, then, so recall, we have this expression for the generating function of correlators of the operators in the CFT as a functional of this source, phi naught, which is, it's approximately e to the minus, so this is in the Euclidean case, e to the minus, the bulk action, evaluated on the solution of the equations of motion such that phi goes to phi naught with the z to the delta plus at the boundary. Right? This was the basic mathematical content of the ADS-CFT correspondence. In the Lorentzian case, in real time, there's an I here, and this formula isn't so true. But in the Euclidean case, it's completely the answer. And secondly, we showed that the bulk action for a scalar field evaluated on the solution of the equations of motion was equal to a boundary term. It was equal to an integral over the boundary with some square root of g's and some phi d phi's, something like this. There's maybe a g, z, z, something like that. I may have the factors wrong here. But the point I want to emphasize is that it's evaluated at the boundary. And so the thing you need to know to figure out this answer for the generating function is just the boundary behavior. And so that's the reason for focusing on the boundary behavior here. So one thing we could imagine doing is, you know, we have some very explicit expression for our solution of some particular Bessel function, which relates, you know, which says which combination of these two solutions extends farther into the interior to a regular solution and relates phi 1 to phi 0. And so we could just take that solution and plug it in here and extract the answer. And you should do that. It's a good exercise. I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to do it a better way. And it's better in that it looks nicer. And also, it works for the Lorentzian case. Whereas this way of thinking about it depends crucially on this minus sign, on the Euclidean minus sign. So here's the nice general trick. To explain the nice general trick, I need to make one more detour into classical mechanics. It's slightly less elementary than this one. It's part of Hamilton-Jacobi theory. How many of you have learned about Hamilton-Jacobi theory? A little bit? Yeah? All right, good. I didn't learn about it when I was younger. So it seems really scary to me. So let me explain it to you in the particular fact that I need in a gentle way. It's actually not so fancy, actually. I'll explain the fact for a particle in one dimension, and then we'll generalize it to some infinite dimensional function space very quickly. So consider a 1D particle in one dimension, whose coordinate is x, and which has some action functional. So x is the coordinate. It's a function of time. And its action, I can write, let's assume it's an integral over time of some Lagrangian period. Yeah, I guess I could write capital L here, right? Lagrangian, not Lagrangian density. And suppose that we constrain its life to live between time t1 and t2. So this is some function of x and x dot. And think about some particular trajectory. Here's t1, here's t2, here's x. So here's x of t1. It does something. Here's x. This is x of t that I'm drawing. And suppose this is a solution of the equations of motion. Suppose that I pick a particular solution of the equations of motion, and I'm interested in how does the value of the on-shell action, the action evaluated on this classical path, vary if I vary the boundary value of the function? Right. So suppose this thing gives some second-order differential equation. I mean, I get to pick two pieces of initial data. I could pick them to be, say, x of t1 and x of t2. And then let me ask, how does the on-shell action, S evaluated on the solution, vary if I vary the boundary condition? Okay, so this kind of thing is exactly the wheelhouse of Hamilton-Jacobi theory, and the answer is actually quite simple. It's that the variation of the action with respect to this boundary condition, t1, that's fine, is just the initial momentum, where by pi, I mean the variation, the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x dot. And this is evaluated at t1. Okay, so this is it's a very plausible statement. It's derived on like the third page of Landau-Lipschitz mechanics, I think. But I'm not going to defend it anymore. But you see that the thing that we want to do here is very similar in that we have the thing we're interested in is some action evaluated on a solution of its equations of motion, and we want to understand how it varies when we vary the boundary condition. So the thing, you know, the thing we want to vary to compute correlation functions is this phi naught, which is the boundary condition. So the thing we're interested in is exactly this kind of thing. Okay? Is it all right? So we can put this fact in a box if you want to derive it later. So now, a slight generalization of that statement to the case of interest, where we're going to replace x of t by phi of z, right? The dynamical variable will be the field as a function of the radial coordinate, and the action will be the action of this field phi of z, and the boundary condition, the analog of x of t1, will be this phi naught. And the only small subtlety is that all of these ingredients also depend on space-time of the boundary theory, or a momentum space. Which, I mean, you could do it point by point in that space, and that statement is true. Okay, there's one more important substitution, which is we're going to think of the radial direction in ADS, think of z as time, and think of the boundary as the initial time, as the time in that problem. And so a mild generalization of that statement is that this variation of the Onshall action, why did I change its name? Okay, well, I'll just call it S bulk of phi naught. With respect to phi naught, is which, by the way, is the thing that we want. All right, So before I write the generalization of the formula, let me just point out that this is the thing that we want. This is O of the expectation value of O of x. Right, that's this statement is. This statement, right? That's if we evaluate. I guess that's if we evaluated it. Oh, sorry. No, this is just true. If we don't evaluate it at phi naught equals zero, it's the expectation value of O of x in the presence of the source, right? You can imagine the source is finite. So this is the thing we want, and so we can use that theorem to figure out what this is. Well, it's something like the limit as z goes to zero. That's the boundary. That's the place where the initial thing happens. So that's the analog of evaluating this at t1. And the thing that we should evaluate is, well, it's nearly just pi of z and x. But there's a few, and where pi of z and x is equal to the derivative of the now Lagrangian density in the bulk with respect to the analog of the time derivative of the field, which is now the z derivative of phi. Right, instead of x dot, it's phi, d phi, ddz of phi. Okay, so is it clear that this structure is the same as that structure? There's two important subtleties that I need to mention. One is that this phi naught is not exactly the boundary value of phi, because of this business that phi goes to, like, z to the delta. Phi goes like z over L to the delta times phi naught. And so we need to use the chain rule here. So if I replace this with the actual boundary value of phi, that would be equal to phi naught times z to the delta. I can put that z to the delta over here. Instead of delta minus. Okay, so that's just some simple bookkeeping issue. But then there's an important second physics issue, which is that the actual response that we're interested in is really the finite part of this. That in this limit when z goes to zero, there can be short distance singularities that are not so interesting. I'll say a little bit more about what's not so interesting about them, but a safe way to use this formula that will protect you from this business is to say. This is true. Use this formula away from the support that is where it's non-zero, the support of the source. So that is to say, if you kick the system at some time and space, at some particular time and space, the response of the system to that perturbation has lots of extra stuff in it at that particular time and space, which is maybe not so interesting. It has to do with the short distance details of what's happening. And really, the much more interesting thing is evaluating this away from the time and space, the space-time event of the kick. Okay, so and I'll say a little more about what exactly happens at this place in a minute. And so with this caveat, the answer, if you plug in, so this is the field momentum, the derivative of the Lagrange with respect to this, which you know is something you can figure out. It's more or less for the free Lagrange we've been talking about. It's something like gzz dz phi times some factor here, times this thing I called curly k. Maybe there's a 1/2. And so you can imagine plugging this boundary behavior of the solution into here and taking this limit to extract off the power here. And if you do that, it's a simple exercise to see that the answer for the response, for the expectation of this operator, is this constant kappa. There's a factor of 2 delta minus d, this is the thing I called nu earlier, over L, times phi 1, where phi 1 is this subleading behavior of the field. So this is the answer for the expectation value of the field. And if we want to think about the linear regime, if we want to think about linear response, so this is a nonlinear equation. In general, the both-hand side of this is some function of the both-hand side depends on phi naught. This thing, you know, this phi 1 depends on phi naught. And so this isn't necessarily, we didn't assume linear response in deriving this. But if we do want to think about the case where the perturbation is small, then we can expand in the size of the perturbation. And it says the change in the expectation of O as a result of the perturbation, by definition, is the Green's function, is the retarded Green's function, if we want the causal change. So from this we conclude, let me write it up here, that the Green's function, which is the retarded one if we evaluated these things on the right solution, the one with the right boundary conditions in the infrared, is just this phi 1 over phi naught up to some numerical prefactors. So that is to say that the response, the Green's function, is this subleading bit of the solution divided by the source. So you perturb it by an amount phi naught, and the answer for the Green's function is the response divided by how much you perturbed it. Okay, so that is the leading behavior of the solution encodes the action of the field theory, right? It codes what we're doing to the field theory, and the subleading behavior of the solution says how the field theory responds. Something about the state that the theory gets put in as a result of all of the horrible things we're doing to it. Okay? Is it clear? This is something I defined last time. I wrote some when I first introduced the scalar field in De Sitter space, I normalized its action with this constant kappa. So I said it was something like this. Plus interactions, which we can ignore in this regime, in the regime where phi naught is small. So that it's just the coefficient in front of the action, which clearly this is proportional to it. Okay. Let me make a comment. So here's an exercise that you all should do. Maybe you can do it tomorrow afternoon. So plug in the solution for this Euclidean, or any so either the Euclidean ADS or Lorentzian ADS solution, where phi is the momentum space solution for phi of z and k with something like some Bessel function. I guess it was z to the d over 2 times Bessel k with a nu of kz. So this is the Euclidean one, and then there's some coefficient here, which we can pick. And notice that the coefficient here will cancel out of the Green's function. Is something I wrote not legible? This I can easily believe.
The line right there. I think you just
linear. Oh, use this. Oh, I see. Yeah. So this was a. This is an important warning, which is what I'm going to explain here. So you should use this formula away from the support of the source, away from where fun.
What is it?
This. Yeah. This.
This.
Away from the support of the source.
Oh, away from the source.
Yeah. Sorry. And so that's exactly the I want to explain to you the necessity for this warning here. So here's some very explicit solution. You can imagine using the asymptotic expansion of the Bessel function when its argument is small, that is, when z is small near the boundary, to figure out what phi naught and phi 1 are. There's some functions of k, yeah? If you evaluate this where the source has support, you'll get some short distance divergences. If you take this limit where z really goes to 0, you'll get infinity. If you evaluate it as z equals epsilon, you'll get something that's some inverse power of epsilon, or a log. This is exactly what I want to explain. If you do this, you'll get some expression for the Green's function. Say the retarded Green's function or the Euclidean Green's function, I won't distinguish between them for the purposes of what I'm going to say, which is, so according to this formula that I wrote here, it's the subleading bit over the leading bit, each of which depends on k. And the way they depend on k is the following. So this is the part that you have to check for yourself. I think it's rude to play with Bessel functions in public, so I'm not going to do it. The answer you'll find is that there's a bit, which is the interesting bit, which is some number times k, the momentum, to the 2 nu, where nu is the same nu that appears here. It's this nu. Nu is equal to 2 delta minus d. Yes. 2 delta plus minus d. So it's just some number, but notice it's not an integer. This thing not being an integer is the same condition as delta plus minus delta minus not being an integer. If it's an integer, then there's a log, okay? So this is the interesting bit, and then there's some other bit, which is some sum of terms, which sum over some integer n, which is positive, of some coefficients underlying, call them alpha n, times k to the 2n. So this, I'm telling you the form of the answer you'll get when you expand the Bessel function and plug it in and figure out what phi naught and phi 1 are according to this formula and plug it into here. It's actually a little hard to get the numerical coefficient right, but let's not worry about that right now. You can ask me about that tomorrow afternoon if you want. So this is the momentum space Green's function. Let's think about the Euclidean case for definiteness. To figure out the real space Green's function, we want to Fourier transform this. Right? We want to integrate over k, e to the minus I k on x, this g of k, whichever g it is. Let's think about the Euclidean one. So there's no subtleties about these integrals. And so there's two terms here. There's the term where we integrate that. There's this number, integral dk, e to the minus I k on x, k to the 2 nu. And then there's the sum over n positive, this coefficient, integral dk, e to the minus ikx, k to the 2n. And so it's very important that these things are integers here. And so let's think about what these two terms are. This integral, this one, let's do it by scaling. So let's scale the dependence on x into k, redefine some integration variable, some new integration variable that has that k in it. You'll be able to convince yourself pretty easily that just dimensional analysis tells you that this thing is like x to the 2 delta, where delta is d over 2 plus mu times this times some other number. This is the answer that we want, right? This is the right answer for the two-point function of a primary operator in a CFT whose dimension is delta plus. Okay, so this is the real convincing argument that this thing I've been calling delta is indeed the scaling dimension. So this is some small victory for us. The second thing is all this other gunk. And these integrals, let's think about them. So what's this integral if n is 0?
A delta function.
Good, thank you. So the first term is a delta function, delta of x, d-dimensional delta function of x. And how can we one way to think about this power of k to the 2n is to, you can get these powers of k to the 2n by differentiating this thing with respect to x, right? If I act with the Laplacian on e to the minus I kx, this thing is del squared. The thing I get is k squared minus k squared e to the minus I kx, right? And so I can rewrite each of these k squareds as a Laplacian and pull them out of the integral, and then the thing that's left is just the delta function, and so this is Laplacian to the n of the delta function. All right? So this is what I mean by short distance goo that nobody's interested in. Because you see, this is only non-zero when x is equal to 0. That is, the two operators whose Green's function we're computing, right, this is O of x, O of 0. The two operators whose Green's function we're computing are right on top of each other. Right? This is trying to measure the response of the system to right where it's being kicked, right, which is some very messy thing that depends on all kinds of short distance horrible things. And so that's, you know, this is only non-zero. It's only non-zero for x equals exactly 0. And so these things are called contact terms. And you may be happy to simply ignore them, right? To only use this prescription, only evaluate the answer away from the support of the source, which, by the way, in this case, the support of the source was exactly what I mean by the support of the source. Here is just x equals 0, right? Our source was just a delta function at x equals 0. You may be happy to use this prescription alternatively if you like worrying about this kind of thing. There's a procedure called holographic renormalization, which very closely mimics the procedure of renormalization in field theory, where one adds local counterterms to the action, which in such a way as to remove these short distance divergences. In this case, the holographic version of a local counterterm is to add to the bulk action boundary terms that are integrals over the boundary, which are intrinsic things, which are things that are, there's some Lagrangian that depends only on phi at the boundary and x. And here, it's in doing this procedure, it's very useful to include a cutoff. So this L is a Lagrangian as a function of phi. So for example, an interesting term that you might want to include here is some constant. So e.g., for example, you can consider the case where this thing is some constant c naught, say just a pure constant independent of anything, maybe c1 phi, maybe c2 phi squared, something like this. And by choosing these constants, you could arduously and carefully cancel these things and have some perfectly well-defined renormalized holographic theory. Many people have a lot of fun doing this. Okay. All right. So two more comments I want to make about correlators. The first is, notice that. Here's our expression for the Green's function. Here's a better one. Here's the expression. Our expression for the Green's function. Something that you may know is that the Green's function of a system, say in frequency space, will have poles at values of the frequency where the system can be excited, right? Where there's an actual mode of the system with that frequency, right? So this is, I guess, the phenomenon of resonance, right? We could go back to the harmonic oscillator example that was under here, right? Right? If you drive a harmonic oscillator with the frequency that's the resonant frequency, there's this big pole in the Green's function at that frequency. And let's think about how that's mimicked here. So one way to get a pole of the Green's function is if phi naught, the source, is finite, or if but phi 1 blows up, the response blows up. That doesn't happen. There's a proof from the theory of differential equations that doesn't happen. So forget about it. The way that it actually happens is that phi 1, the response is finite. Here, let me write this over here. how do you get, so the question on the table is, how do you get poles of G? Let's talk about the retarded Green's function. So a pole of G would occur at some frequency where phi 1 of omega, and say nk, is finite, but phi naught of omega and k, and let's put some stars on here to say that this is occurring for some special value of the frequency of momentum, but phi naught is 0. What it means for phi naught to be 0 is that there's no source. Right? That's saying that even if you leave the system alone, this is what will happen. Right? And so the saying that there's a finite response without a source is saying that it's something that the system does on its own, even if you're not perturbing it. And so that's exactly what it means for the system to have a state with those quantum numbers. And so this is a rather beautiful intimate relationship between the way the holographic calculation works, namely with this business with the subleading and subleading terms of the solution, and poles of the Green's function. That is to say, the subleading bit of the solution is really encoding facts about the system. It's really encoding information about the possible states of the system. Okay, and when this happens, the system is said to have, in general, a quasi-normal mode. And the word quasi is a reference to the fact that it's possible for omega to be, omega star may be complex. It may have some imaginary part. Which would mean that it's damped, right? That means that it doesn't just ring forever. It'll die off eventually. Okay. There's one more comment I want to make about correlation functions, which is to give you some hint about how to compute a correlation function that's more than a two-point function. Yes, please. This one.
This is defining the conjugate momentum.
I just erased the definition of the conjugate momentum.
I don't see if we are taking a variation in respect to phi naught.
So this is where I was using this Hamilton-Jacobi result. So this relation is the Hamilton-Jacobi result that I was quoting over there. The conjugate momentum evaluated at the initial point, at the initial time, where you should think of time as like z, is equal to this variation of the on-shell action with respect to the boundary condition. Yeah. So that's this was the input from Hamilton-Jacobi. So it's just classical mechanics. It happens that we're studying classical mechanics of a classical mechanical system where there's infinitely many degrees of freedom. But this x just goes along for the ride. It's true for each x. Okay, maybe I'll leave this here for another minute. And erase this guy. So I want to talk about endpoint functions. So far we've talked about two-point functions. Let me say a little bit about endpoint functions. So actually, this formula already has all the information about endpoint functions. Because you see, if you can compute the one-point function as a functional of the source, if you differentiate it more times with respect to the source, you get endpoint functions. Right? If I differentiate this again with respect to phi naught, I get the two-point function, which is that's really what we did here. And so you could just differentiate this again and get the endpoint functions. But since we're interested in not, since in general it's hard to find the solution with finite values of phi naught, where you have some real, gigantic source that's not small, it's much easier to find the solution in perturbation theory in the size of the source. And so there's a very useful visualization of how to do this, which is called Witten diagrams. And it's really just Feynman diagrams in anti-de-Sitter space. So suppose we're interested in, say, a three-point function. Then we could get this by we would get this by differentiating our generating function three times with respect to the source and evaluating it at phi naught equals 0, or we could differentiate our one-point function once or twice with respect to the source. There's some numerical factor there that I'm going to get wrong. But notice that in computing this, the cubic coupling matters. The interactions matter. So let me consider a simple example. Mm-hmm. Let's just do this. So now the self-interactions of our field, so the equation of motion is something like this. There's a b phi squared. I think I'll be a little bit heuristic here. The equation of motion for the scalar field is this. Previously, we had ignored this phi squared term because we said that it was proportional to phi naught, which was small. But the solution of this equation, we could think of this as some perturbation. Find a Green's function for this operator, right? And just invert this, put it over here, and find the solution for phi z. And so that's really what we'll do. And so really, it's just that procedure. But there's a nice visualization that I want to show. So phi is something like an integral. Okay, it's an integral over the boundary. So if you like, there's really two sources. One is there's the source for this guy from the fact that it has some boundary value, and the propagator that propagates from the boundary value to the interior is something that we could call the boundary to bulk propagator. Let's call it K delta ZX. X1 phi naught of X1. So this is in fact the solution that we found earlier. So this is this is just we found the solution in momentum space just by Fourier transform. We could, given some arbitrary source on the boundary, you could tell me what is the solution in the bulk. So this was the solution without worrying about the interactions. Okay. So this is something you could infer from the previous things I've told you. So this is the boundary to bulk propagator. It's the solution of box minus m squared phi equals zero that approaches a delta function at the boundary with the right power of epsilon z to the delta minus with the right power of z. Okay, this is the definition of this thing. So you see, if I add together a bunch of these, I'll get the solution for phi, which has the boundary condition phi naught. Okay, but we haven't yet included this source here. And then the next step is just to include this interaction here, an integral over the bulk. Let's call this x prime dz prime, a bulk-to-bulk Green's function, which I'll call gigantic capital G, with a delta, because it's a delta because it knows about the mass, of z and x, z prime x prime, times two more things that propagate from the boundary . So I'm going to write a somewhat bewildering expression here involving many different variables in the bulk, and then I'll draw a picture which will explain it completely. Okay, that's the end. All right, so here's a picture of that equation. And it's the comparison between the horror of that equation and the simplicity of the picture I'm about to draw that makes this visualization technique useful. Okay, so this first term that I drew is this. So here's the point z comma x, here's the point x1. So you see, we take a point on the boundary, x1. Yes. This is multiplied by this, yeah, that's right. Sorry. I'm going to draw a picture of this first term. We take a point on the boundary x1, and we propagate it using this boundary to bulk propagator k to some point in the bulk z and x, which is the point that we're interested in. All right. So this is the picture of this term. And then we add to that, there's a b times the following thing. We take two points on the boundary, x1 and x2. Where we have this source, here's x1, here's x2. We take two points in the boundary, and we propagate each of them to some point in the interior, which is z comma x. Is that what I called it? No, z prime comma x prime. So each of them gets propagated to z prime x prime, by this bounder to bulk propagator. And then we use the bulk to bulk propagator to propagate from z prime x prime to zx, which is the point that we're interested in. Okay. And then there's some plus order b squared terms. You could do more complicated things, which involve more powers of the source. So this bulk to bulk propagator g this is the bulk to bulk propagator. It's also just it's a Green's function for the bulk Laplacian, which it's g. It's the thing that satisfies the equation with the source. This is g of xz, x prime, z prime, is equal to a delta function in the bulk, a deep one-dimensional delta function. I guess there's a square root of g to make it covariant, which sets z equal to z prime and x equal to x prime. And the boundary condition is that it goes to, at the boundary, it goes to z to the delta minus 10, 0. It's normalizable. This is times plus something of order z to the delta plus. Yes? You're asking what this means?
Yeah. Is that what you mean by g?
What do I mean by g? This g is this line here. Yes, sorry. Here I was explaining what I meant by this symbol, which pictorial is denoted by this line here, and this is zx. So the more, if you want, me to draw a more complicated diagram, let's see. So the next diagram we could try to draw is something like, if we only have a 3-point vertex, we could do something like this. Right? So that is, we could do something that involves three sources and two interactions. So the B, by the way, this vertex here, this is an insertion of this 3-point vertex, right? That's why the fact that we have a phi cubed interaction is why there's three things here, and we can use that again. Each of these comes with a B. We have more integrals, an extra bulk, a bulk to bulk propagator, an extra bulk to boundary propagator. Okay? Yes. What did I write here? So here I'm saying, so I'm trying to specify this bulk-to-bulk propagator as a particular solution of this differential equation. I'm saying it satisfies the wave equation with the source, and it's normalizable. Its boundary condition near the boundary, so g as you go to the boundary, is only the subleading bit. The bit which would tell you the source of the boundary is zero. Okay? So this is maybe some heavy lifting, but it's really a very straightforward application of perturbative field theory. The only distinction is that, and these diagrams really are just Feynman diagrams. The only distinction is that in Feynman diagrams in Minkowski space, you're used to think the lines that go off at the ends of the diagrams represent asymptotic states in Minkowski space, right? Namely, plane waves or wave packets, right? The kinds of states that you can prepare from null infinity and send in and scatter. Whereas here, the lines that go off to the boundary represent asymptotic states in anti-de Sitter space, which are these solutions that go like this boundary behavior of K. That is, these insertions of the sources. So this circle is meant to, it's a cartoon indicating the boundary of anti-de Sitter space. But they're really just Feynman diagrams of this funny theory. Okay. It's okay? All right, there's one more thing I can't resist saying about correlators. Which is, there's a limit where the story is very simple, and which is actually a very useful thing to keep in mind, which is, the thing we're doing there over here is really, we're really just solving this differential equation, right? We're just solving this differential equation, which, you know, it happens to be the wave equation for some field. And okay, and these things are really just, you know, lines representing the propagation of some more or less free particles, some weakly interacting particles in the bulk of ADS. And there's a limit where the behavior of particles simplifies dramatically, which is, I guess there are many such limits, but one such limit is when the particle is very heavy, right? Meaning that its Compton wavelength is much smaller than any of the other scales in the problem. And in this limit, you can treat it really as a particle, and you can solve this, you can solve equations like this using geometric optics, right? You can really follow the paths of the particles. So maybe, well, let me try to, let me say two more words about this. A limit where this happens is when, from the field theory point of view, it's when the dimension of the operator is very large, which according to this relationship that I keep writing, between the mass of the bulk field and the dimension of the operator, you know, if delta is large, you can ignore the d here. This goes like delta squared. And so delta being large says that the mass of the particle is large in units of the ADS radius. And so, you know, one example where this happens is, that I mentioned before, is if the particle happens to be some d-brain. Okay, so that's a way to realize this. And in this limit, we can use this geometric optics approximation. And what I mean by this is, suppose we're interested in the two-point function, say it's an operator with very large dimension at some point A, which is, say, one of the spatial coordinates of the boundary theory, and the conjugate operator inserted at point minus A. And suppose we're talking about the Euclidean theory, and this A is just some spatial coordinate. So here's a picture of that spatial coordinate. Here's A, here's minus A, here's A, here's the origin. And this way I'll draw the radial coordinate, and then it's going to be useful to have a cutoff here. Then, you know, one way to compute this is we're inserting some, you know, we're creating one of these heavy particles here. It's going to follow some GD-sic in the bulk. It follows some, you know, it tries to move in a straight, what locally is a straight line. And then we're going to demand that the particle is absorbed here. Right, so it's going to be forced to follow a GD-sic that has a boundary condition here, that it starts at the boundary, goes into the bulk, and here it gets absorbed at the boundary again. And so that is to say, we can think about this two-point function as a path integral over paths of this particle from this point to this point. So this x is describing the trajectory of the particle in the bulk, where at the initial time, I don't know, let's call it t naught, it's forced to be at the point minus a z equals epsilon. That's this point in this picture. Epsilon is the regulator. And at the final time, it's forced to be at the point plus a z equals epsilon. Right? So somehow, you know, so this is, we're going to do an integral over all paths here, right? Over all possible paths that start here and end here. And there's some action here, which, let's talk about the Euclidean case, is e to the minus s, some action for that particle, where the action for a heavy particle, if it's not charged, there's no background fields, it's just the mass times the length of the world line. This is the mass of the particle, the m that appears here. And this integral ds is just the length of the world line in ADS, in the bulk. The length of the world line in the bulk. The length of the path. And now, in the limit where this m is much bigger than LADS, so this, the length scales appearing in here are just the ADS radius. So if you like, this is m times L times some dimensionless world line length. And so when m is much bigger than L, this, you know, the coefficient in front of the action in this integral is really big, and so this, you know, cries out for some saddle point approximation. So this is m much bigger than 1 over l. So in that limit, you can do this integral by saddle point, and that's what I mean by this geometric Optis limit. So here we didn't assume anything. We just assumed that there was a particle propagating from here to here. We sum over its trajectories. That's just the world line description of the solution of this equation. But in the limit where the mass is large, that sum over paths is dominated by the classical trajectory, which is just a geodesic. It's the geodesic in ADS that satisfies this boundary condition, which, as I'm sure many of you know, is a semicircle. If you evaluate the length of that path, the length of that semicircle, you'll find it's very important to regulate it. It's 2L times m, this is this m times L that we pulled out before, times a logarithm of a over epsilon. So a is the epsilon is this cutoff. It's this length cutoff, the distance, how close to the boundary we go, and a is this half the separation. And so notice when we plug this into here, plug this logarithm into this exponential, they're kind enough to eat each other, and we get a over epsilon to the minus m. And there's a 2, minus 2m, which is m is delta. 2ml is delta. This is equal to delta. Delta plus. And so this is the right answer, right? The correlation function, the two-point function of some primary operator dimension delta separated by a distance a. We could put a 2 here without lying. Separated by a distance 2a goes like the separation to the minus 2 delta. All right, so this is victory. Yeah? So this was the fact that the Anschel action had this logarithm is a claim that I'm making, which I encourage you to check. It's just a matter of finding this geodesic, finding the geodesic with these boundary conditions and evaluating its length. So part of the reason that I went through the trouble of saying this is that this correlation function is something that you could imagine computing in the field theory, right? You could imagine pick some time and space for this to be inserted. So we did a very simple example here, but we could have picked different times and spaces and locations here, and by varying those times and locations, we can vary the trajectory of this particle through the bulk. And the particle has some very sharp, well-defined trajectory in the limit where the mass is large. And so in this way, these correlation functions of large dimensional operators allow you to probe the geometry of the bulk, right? Because you could imagine sending these geodesics where you want them to go if you knew enough about this map. And so people have used this quite extensively, for example, to try to understand the singularity inside a black hole in antipsychotic space. By studying correlation functions in the dual field theory, by varying where you insert the operators. Yeah, I guess I should. Yeah, the people who did this are Steve Schenker and collaborators. Okay, are there any questions about correlation functions? Yes.
Well, I have any question.
Yeah. Good. I was using the action that I was using before. I was assuming we had a scalar field in ADS whose action had some k in front of it, some, I guess there's a minus sign, some kinetic term, some mass term, and then it can have, and I assumed that it had some interaction b phi cubed. And I guess I assumed that it had some interaction b phi cubed over 3. So that the equation motion is this. Good. Okay, yes?
These diagrams, it's a perturbative thing, right?
Right, it's perturbative in the size of the source. It's perturbative in phi naught. Right, so that you see the diagrams with more things happening involve more appearances of the insertions at the boundary. That's right. It's for sure not in the coupling of the dual field theory, right? That appears nowhere. You'll notice that I didn't draw any loops in these diagrams. A loop, you can convince yourself, would, so a diagram like, what's a good example? I don't know, something like this, where this is some loop of the scalar field, would cost a power of the coupling kappa in front of here. Right? This would be down by some power of kappa to the minus 1, h bar, if you like, for the scalar field, which I said that I was going to assume that this kappa was of order n squared, that just like the gravity action had a big n squared in front of it, this action has a big n squared in front of it. And so this it's for this reason that the thing is classical. That is, it's the same fact that the number of degrees of freedom per point of the field theory is large that makes this field classical. So loops are down by that number, by large n. And you can convince yourself that powers of this coupling constant here are always accompanied by extra powers of the boundary insertion. So it really is perturbation theory in phi naught, which is, it's just classical perturbation theory because of this fact. So this, you know, these things are like quantum gravity effects, which are small if n is big. Okay. So I said something about black holes just now. I'm gonna say many more things about black holes. But I guess it's 12:43, huh? Do you people have to eat lunch? So inconvenient. Okay. All right. We'll talk about black holes. So remember, tomorrow I'm not giving a lecture. Tammy is giving a lecture at this time, and my next lecture is Friday morning at 10:15.